I must begin today with a confession. You see before you a tired intern. My wife and I underwent a rough spell of norovirus earlier this week. But in addition to that, it's not just that I stayed up late last night preparing these remarks and deliberating what to say to you today, though that had something to do with it. Call it mid-semester blues, call it impeachment fatigue. Perhaps it's this election cycle that never seems to end. Or the news of epidemic spreading in China. Perhaps it's the illnesses and deaths I've seen touch family and friends. Many lately, it seems, in this congregation. Part of my fatigue, I think, stems from this terrible habit I've developed lately of looking for God in all the wrong places. The news. Where is God in the news? Where is God in our public discourse? Our politics? Where is God in the outbreak of disease? The violence in our schools or in our churches? Where is God in disappointing prognoses and tragic family losses? As I meditated on today's Old Testament lesson, I couldn't help but reflect on these kinds of questions. Somewhere along the way, it seems Christian theology lost its sense of lament, its willingness to turn to God and ask the difficult question, where are you? It is a question I believe pervades the entire Hebrew Bible. The language surrounding the God of Israel is rather different from that of the God we find in philosophy or even theology. God is never defined systematically as all-powerful, all-knowing, or all-good. In the Old Testament, the God of Israel is always somewhat hidden. Take, for instance, the puzzling name God gives Moses from the burning bush in Exodus 3:14. I am who I am. Tell them I am sent you. God almost sounds like a politician, giving elusive answers to what appear to be straightforward questions, refusing to be pinned down. But then again, the same phrase might also be translated, I shall be who I shall be. And when compared with, say, Jeremiah 24:7, things begin to come a little more into focus. I will give them a heart to know that I am the Lord, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God. For they shall return to me with their whole heart. God of chosen Israel is the God who is known only in relationship, hidden. God chooses, and in choosing, God reveals. The question, where is God, is at the center of today's word from the book of Isaiah. Scholars today generally believe the book of Isaiah was written during three different periods of history. Our reading today is from what scholars call 3rd Isaiah, believed to have been written sometime after the return from Babylonian exile. This was a time and place when the returning Israelites were discovering that their homecoming was not entirely what it had been cracked up to be. The promise of the prophets of a restored Israel, of verdant gardens, high holy places, peace and prosperity had failed to arrive. Though they had been allowed to return home, they were in fact a Persian colony, oppressed by local officials in the forms of heavy taxes, usurious loans, and unfavorable economic conditions. It also led to the enslavement to other Jews when debts could not be repaid. Land disputes were arising between the returning exiles and those who had remained. Jerusalem was not turning out to be the shining city on the hill, but rather a place of growing violence and uncertainty. At the center of this uncertainty emerges Isaiah 58 in its controversy over fasting. Fasting had been a part of Israelite piety from the earliest of times. In the exile, it had been conducted as a way of remembering the destruction of Jerusalem, a practice which became institutionalized upon the return into four occasions throughout the year. This practice was tied to Israel's remembrance of loss and exile, and also as a way of asserting their identity as God's chosen people, as well as their claim on the promises God had spoken and revealed through the prophets. Thus, the people addressed by the prophet here were highly religious, seekers of righteousness, ones delighting to know God's ways, seeking to draw ever nearer to him. One might say they are not unlike today's regular churchgoer. If any in Israel had the right to ask, "Where is God?" surely it was these. Having kept the fast, having humbled themselves, surely their cries to the God of Israel won't go unheard. Surely their devotion won't go unseen. Why is it then that to them, God remains hidden? Look, you serve your own interest on your fast day and oppress all your workers. Look, you fast only to quarrel and to fight, and to strike with a wicked fist. Such fasting as you do today will not make your voice heard on high. When religious devotion leads to the oppression of workers, to quarreling and division, to actual violence, then the fruits of this fast are not merely sterile. They're counterproductive. They're evidence of religiosity that has become an end unto itself. Is it a wonder, then, that they cannot see God in this sort of devotion? Yet hidden, God chooses, and in choosing, God reveals. Is this not the fast that I choose? To loose the bonds of injustice, to let the oppressed go free, is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house, when you see the naked to cover them, and not to hide yourself from your own kin? Then your light shall break forth like the dawn, and your healing shall spring up quickly. Your vindicator shall go before you. The glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. You shall cry for help, and he will say, "Here I am." In choosing this fast, God reveals unequivocally not only the kind of devotion required, but also who God is and who God's people are called to be. As if to drive home the point, the prophet reiterates and expounds upon the call in an if-then construction. If you remove the yoke from among you, the pointing of the finger, the speaking of evil, if you offer your food to the hungry and satisfy the needs of the afflicted, then your light shall break forth like the dawn, and your healing shall spring up quickly. Your vindicator shall go before you. The glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. If then, there's a temptation here to read a covenant of works from this passage, as some have. A tit-for-tat arrangement in which God gives blessings and salvation to those who do works pleasing in God's sight. Such a reading would be to reduce the message to that of a mere prosperity gospel. It would be to fall prey to the same mistake that the Israelites themselves make in their own devotional lives. It is God who chooses, a people and a time and place through which God's healing and salvation will shine forth in the world. Here it is important to pay attention to the symbol of this salvation God chooses to speak through the prophet. Your light shall break forth like the dawn. Your light shall rise in the darkness, and your gloom be like the noonday. Light, the revealer, that energy that shows forth what was previously unseen, the ungraspable, unpossessable force that reveals what lies hidden to the eye. They themselves are to be the light rising in the darkness. Their gloom is to be as the noonday. Notice the prophet did not say, your gloom will suddenly depart from you, that the world will be filled with light that drowns out even their own darkness. No, in a world where darkness pervades, it is precisely their gloom which becomes the light. They themselves will be as a watered garden. They will become, in the words of today's gospel lesson, a city built on a hill that cannot be hidden. It is no coincidence that the very words out of God's mouth, the very first words in this book that we call the Bible, are "let there be light." It is no coincidence that this word of God, this word of light spoken into creation, is identified by the Gospel of John with Jesus Christ. All things came into being through him, and without him, not one thing came into being. What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. That light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. It is no coincidence, brothers and sisters, that Jesus in today's gospel says to us, his disciples, you are the light of the world. God chooses, and in choosing, God reveals. God has spoken light into this world, a world where God is difficult to see. It is a choice that does call us to feed the hungry, does call us to welcome the homeless, it does call us to clothe the naked. Even more so, it calls us to the very difficult task of removing, of pointing the finger, and fighting with our neighbors. And yes, the even more radical and difficult task of loving our enemies. In all things, God chooses and calls us to be visions of God's grace. The past few weeks, I've had the pleasure of spending time with our confirmands as they prepare to affirm the claim God has placed on their lives as both God's children and disciples of Christ. This week, we discuss the fruits and gifts of the Spirit. My favorite part of our meeting was when we passed our confirmation journals around the table and we each wrote down and identified gifts that the other one had, gifts that we saw would serve God's church in the world. In closing of our meeting, we read a prayer together from the 16th century mystic reformer and writer Teresa of Avila. That's one I wish to share and close with you today. Christ has no body but yours, no hands, no feet on earth but yours. Yours are the eyes with which he looks compassion on this world. Yours are the feet with which he walks to do good. Yours are the hands with which he blesses all the world. Yours are the hands, yours are the feet, yours are the eyes. You are his body. Christ has no body but yours, no hands, no feet on earth but yours. Yours are the eyes with which he looks, compassion on this world. Christ has no body now on earth but yours.